Dun dun ts, ts dun ts, dun dun ts, ts dun dun ts, dun dun ts, dun dun ts, ts ts, da 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 Hey everybody, it's Dan. What's happening? Did you like that? That's the new theme song. That is eventually Super Train theme. Huh? What do you think? Look, Tom's down at iPodCon in Duluth. iPodCon 17 in Duluth. Or is that iPodCon? I'm not 100% sure how that's pronounced. I've never been. I'm not an iPod. So I didn't have any music, so I thought I'd write a quick theme. So I hope you enjoyed that. I thought it was pretty entertaining myself. And if there's anyone out there musically inclined who's listening and you want to orchestrate that, hey, it'll stop me from sounding like a jackass for the rest of the run of this series. So, where are we? Eventually Supertrain episode 27. I know what you're thinking. Dan, Eventually Supertrain, the podcast that all the cool kids are listening to? You bet your sweet Aunt Fanny. And speaking of Aunt Fanny, I was reading through some of my new book today, 80s Action Movies on the Cheap, which you can get at any reputable online retailer. It's very, very good, or so I've been told. And I was reading my review of Ninja Demons Massacre, one of the Holai group from the second half of the 80s. And in it, the final paragraph bemoans the fact that there is no Demons Massacre throughout it. And I say in one sentence, Demons Massacre, my Aunt Fanny. As in Demons Massacre, comma, my Aunt Fanny. Well, the original review had the comma there. The copy editor, for some reason, removed the comma. So in the book, it now says, Demons Massacre, my Aunt Fanny. Which actually sounds like a low-budget, sort of late 80s or more 90s shot-on-video film. But yeah, sorry, folks. The sentence now sounds very odd. Where was I? Da-da-da-da, bom, bam. It's catchy. So, episode 27. If you're new to the show, welcome. Thank you so much for joining us. We're all about short-lived TV shows. We go through episode by episode, three shows at a time. And in this episode, we are beginning with a segment with Amy the Conqueror and myself discussing episode... Well, what are we discussing? It's episode 16, Pursuit of 1982-83's Voyagers. Then I am discussing, by myself, episode 4 of The Immortal, The Legacy from 1970. And then Charlie Brown of the Mother Effin' Browns and I are discussing Night of the Scorpion with freaking Doug McClure from 1983's Manimal. It's going to be a good time. And yeah, let's dive right in to Voyagers.
Travel through time to help history along. Give it a push where it's needed. When the Omni's red, it means history's wrong. Our job is to get everything back on track.
Which episode of Voyagers is it that stars the killer from Headless Eyes and the star of one of my all-time favorite movies, Stunt Rock? Could it be Pursuit? You're darn right it is. We're going to meet up with both of them shortly. But first I want to introduce my good pal and Voyager, co-Voyager, fellow Voyager, Amy the Conqueror. How you doing, Amy?
I'm doing good. How are you?
I'm doing all right. Yeah, I'm ready to discuss Pursuit, which is an interestingly structured episode compared to a lot of the other ones.
Yes, it is.
And this is, let's see, Pursuit aired March 6th, 1983. Is that correct? Yes, that's correct. Directed by Alan Meyerson. Didn't he direct Police Academy 5? I'm going to have to look into that. And it's written by Henry and Renee Longstreet, who worked with Kenneth Johnson and James Perriott a lot. But Amy, if you would like to do the breakdown, I will step aside for a moment.
Sure. This is a different episode. At least the way it starts is a little different. It starts with a montage of rocket launches and rocket failures and newspaper headlines, and that goes on for a couple minutes, telling the story of how the space race was going back in the day, and the race to get to the moon and into space between the Russians and the U.S. And these headlines are all showing that the Russians were the ones who got to the moon first and the U.S. did not. So that was an interesting way to start the episode. It's not usual for them. They usually just jump right into it, but this gave a little background to where the story was going. When Bog and Jeffrey finally appear, they land in Florida at what Jeffrey hopes is Cape Kennedy, but it's actually still Cape Canaveral. And we find out that it's Jeffrey's birthday, and he had chosen to come there because Bog said, anywhere you want to go, and Jeffrey chose to see the first launch of the space shuttle. So they land in Cape Canaveral, and they're at a gas station called Wally's Gas Station, an aerospace museum.
Hello? Is anybody here?
No, there's nobody here. Gas just pumps itself.
Hi.
What can I do for you, pilgrims?
Well, this is Cape Kennedy, isn't it?
Canaveral. Cape Canaveral. You guys missed a ship or something?
Oh, no. But we did hear about the museum. Pretty hard to go anywhere without people talking about Wally's museum, huh?
Absolutely famous. You hungry? You look hungry.
Hungry.
I got moon dogs, rocket burgers, orbit colas right up here at the snack stand. Absolutely famous. Hardly need to advertise. Well, the gas business, now that's another story. Been kind of slow ever since the government moved out.
Moved out? What about the moonshot?
Hey, wasn't that something? Those Russians really know how to put on a show, don't they? Of course, you couldn't understand a darn thing they were saying.
You mean the Russians got to the moon?
Yeah, about 2 years ago. Now, for just about 50 cents, I've got a picture, color, of course, some genuine Russian stamps. And that isn't all. Yes, sir?
We were kind of interested in the American space program.
Well, sure, I guess we're all a little patriotic. But the Russian stuff, that's the best part of the tour.
What happened? What happened to the Americans?
Kind of missed the boat, I'm sorry to say. A little like your friend here. You know, the real rocket mines were the German V-2 scientists in World War II. And we were supposed to get them over here.
Well, you mean like Wernher von Braun?
Yeah. Well, thanks. I was on my way to get this. Moondog. Listen, it's all in the museum, guys. Better than I can tell it.
Yeah, well, we're kind of in a hurry, Wally. Do you think you could just tell us what happened? Where'd they go?
Well, the way the story goes, they were all hiding out in the Austrian Alps, and one of their own scientists handed them over to some Nazi general, and he handed them over to the Russians. That's how they got to the moon.
Wouldn't happen to know the date, would you?
Not happen to, friend. I have a picture of those guys the day the Russians got them. May 2nd, 45.
So they land in a little village in Austria, and they decide they're going to look for von Braun, and try to set things right. As they're walking around town, you know, trying to figure out what their plan of action is, a man comes up to them and is like, nope, don't walk towards the Nazis, come with me. And they get rounded up anyways by the Nazi general and his men who are in town looking for Von Braun. I don't know why I can't say his name.
You'll get it.
Von Braun and the scientists are here. My information is unquestionable.
I tried, I'm sorry.
I cannot waste any more time. Scientists are here somewhere in this village. It will not go well for any of you if I do not find them.
Got any extras?
You have no papers?
Not exactly, we were just...
There is very little time. The Russians are advancing from the east. The Americans approach from the south. And you think they will be kind? I doubt it. I intend to have Dr. von Braun and his colleagues in my custody. And believe me, they'll help all of our causes.
Hey, General.
Yeah. Oh, so. Enough. You're all at liberty. For the moment.
So, it turns out that they get away from the Nazis because they one of the Nazi general gets a note from one of his informants or a spy or something like that that tells them that they know where Von Braun is. So, hey, I said it right this time.
Yeah.
So they go with this guy. We find out his name is Ernst, and he's actually a friend of Von Braun and all the scientists. So he takes them to their hideout. They meet up with him and, you know, a bunch of other scientists. One of them happens to be an attractive blonde, so you know where that's going. Mm-hmm. And from because the traitor handed the note, the Nazis know where Von Braun and his scientists are hiding out. So they eventually show up, start banging on the door. They all panic and start going out a hidden doorway in the back or hidden passageway to get out of the building. And Bog stays back a little bit and lets them all go and, of course, fights off some Nazis because you can't miss that opportunity to have Bog fighting Nazis, at least in my opinion.
Yeah, for about 15 seconds, I thought he is going to defeat every single Nazi. That's the way they had it set up.
I believe he could.
Me too.
So he throws some tear gas, locks them in the room. They're good. So Bog, Jeffrey, and the scientists all go to a campsite in the woods about 5 miles outside of the village they were at, where they have a little setup with other German scientists who are trying to get to the Americans, who are supposedly south of the village. And the Russians are coming in from the east. At this point, the Germans know they're losing the war, so the Nazi general wants to hand the German scientists over to the Russians so that they basically don't end up in camps because they want to help out the Russians. Because they know they're losing and, you know, might as well save yourself, I guess, is their yeah. view on it. So the scientists are, you know, Bog says, hey, there's a traitor in your midst because they knew where you are. So somebody here is not, you know, on the up and up. And Von Braun is kind of he's kind of wishy-washy. He doesn't really want to be involved anymore.
Yeah.
He's like, you know, people need to make their own decisions. I'm not going to make the decisions for my friends anymore. But, you know, he had been their leader, and he's obviously an important part of their science. But try to convince him, you know, you need to step up here. You got these people into this. Yeah. Come on. You know, you can't just back out now. And, you know, we all agree with that. So they come up with a little plan that Ernst and Jeffrey are going to go into town or at least try to get to the south of town to find the Americans. And if they could find the Americans, then the Americans will take them all to America. And, you know, in Jeffrey's eyes, this gets the space program back on the right track. So as they're doing that, they do run into a small group of American soldiers, but there's not enough of them to, like, you know, launch a full-scale rescue or anything. So when they go back to Von Braun and everyone, they decide, you know, we got to get to the Americans on the south of town, which means we have to go through the village. Also, they need to get in touch with all the other groups of scientists that are hiding out, trying to get to America as well. So they have a little radio crystal, as they were calling it, that they were going to use to broadcast over a secret frequency to all the other scientists that only they could hear. The Nazis couldn't hear, the Russians couldn't hear, and so on. So it's decided that Bog and the blonde scientist I mentioned before, her name is Dr. Erica Schulman, and one of the group is from the town and not one of the scientists from Germany, so Bog suspects that he is the traitor. So Bog's like, I'm going to stick with these guys. You know, he wants to make sure things go as they should, and if this guy, I wish I could remember his name, was the...
Not Otto. How about Klaus? We can call him Klaus?
Yeah, Klaus sounds good.
Maybe you do, let me, while you're talking, let me see if I can just scan through the episode. Maybe I can get you his name. Let me have a look.
Okay. So Bog and Dr. Schulman and the townsperson go back into town, and they figured, you know, a woman, they won't bother her, which I don't agree with. I'm sure the Nazis bothered lots of women. Go back into town and try to get to this townsperson's house so they could do this radio transmission. But first, they got to steal a radio. So Bog, once again, being the hero, goes up to a Nazi who happens to have a radio in his back seat. And this was my favorite line, was as a distraction, he goes up to the Nazi and he says, how do you break a Nazi's finger? And the Nazi just looks at him and he says, you punch him in the nose, and pulls his hat over his head, over the Nazi's head, and runs away. So the Nazi starts running after him, leaving the radio open for Dr. Schulman and the other guy to grab it. So they grab the radio, they go to his apartment, and they're making the transmission. At some point, Bog realizes that they're... I called him Bob.
Kurt is the name of the guy.
Kurt, okay. Yes. So Kurt and Erica and Bog are all up in his apartment, Kurt's apartment, and Bog realizes that she had never used the crystal that was supposed to transmit over the secret frequency. So right then he realizes she's the traitor.
We've been had, Kurt. She's taking the drugs. She's the traitor.
The rendezvous point will be approximately...
Kummer?
Yes, but you don't understand.
Fauna trusted you even more than the others.
I can explain.
How could anyone explain what you've done?
You cannot possibly think I would do such a thing out of choice. I've learned to hate the Nazis. Their cause is despicable. Their war is despicable.
Then why?
They forced me.
No one's forcing you. We're all alone here, Erica. It's just you, me, and Kurt.
Would you have me sacrifice my family?
You said your family was dead.
No. My brother, Edward. Kamala had him arrested in Hamburg. Now he's a prisoner here at the village. To force me. Don't you see? I'm sorry. I'm terribly ashamed.
That's not going to help us now.
And if they had someone you loved, what would you do, Kurt?
This part was a little weird. They kind of forgive her really quickly because she says, well, you know, they forced me to do it. They have my brother. They said they would kill him. So that's why I'm turning on all of you. And they forgive her pretty quick, you know.
They do. Well, they're, you know, they're German.
Yeah.
Or what are they? What are they?
They're Austrians.
The Austrians, all right. Yeah, Austrians are always more forgiving than Germans.
I guess so. And Bog just has a thing for Dr. Schulman, so He was, you know, he was all about forgiving her and, you know, not making it a big deal. They got over it pretty quick. And Bog, who I think is learning a lot from Jeffrey, comes up with all kinds of great plans and decides that, you know, what they're going to do is use the prototype rockets that the German scientists have at their camps that you're trying to smuggle out with all their research to create like smoke bombs to make the Germans think that they're being attacked by the Americans. At this point, the Germans already know that Hitler is dead, so they find that out during the episode after they hear the transmission from Schulman. And they go outside. All the German soldiers are panicking because they think they're getting bombed, and you know, Bog and Kurt and whoever are yelling, the Americans are coming. I see thousands of Americans.
Oh, yes.
They're coming. And, you know, so the Nazi soldiers freak out and leave. And, but not before Bog takes off and goes and rescues, Schulman's brother. His name was Edward. So they rescue Schulman's brother, and the Nazis leave. So basically, everything's good. They'll get the scientists to the Americans, and you know, green light.
Yay.
So they got their green light, and of course, Bog makes out with the scientist chick
for
a while.
Sure.
Because you know that's what he does. And then they jump back to Cape Kennedy now, and Jeffrey gets to have his birthday wish and see the space shuttle launch, and then he gets to watch the moon landing on TV. So, you know, all's right with the world.
Yay. And then, thank you, Amy. And it ends with a great moment with, what is it, when they're leaving wherever they're at, and Jeffrey says, "When's your birthday, Bog?" And Bog
yep.
just kind of gives him a laugh, and you never quite learn when his yeah. birthday is.
I thought that he said that because he knew they went through they had a little moment where Jeffrey was like kind of sympathetic because Bog wasn't going to see Erica
yes.
again. And I mean, they didn't seem to have that much of a connection in the
yeah,
show to me.
I didn't think so either. That was it was a little odd the way it was handled. I didn't mind her as much as the ladies in the last two. I mean, yeah, she's the traitor, so she's probably caused more problems than the ladies in the last two episodes who have liked Bog.
Yeah.
But it's Monique Van de Ven. She was one of the stars of Stunt Rock, which is one of my all-time favorites. Have you seen Stunt Rock?
Oh, yes, I have. I didn't even put that together.
She's an undercover girl or whatever. She plays herself in Stunt Rock.
Oh, awesome.
She's Dutch. She was married to Jan de Bont, the cinematographer and the guy who made Speed 2. He also made Speed. I just like to say Speed 2 first because it's such a dumb movie. But I do like her, and I've seen her. She was in an episode of Wizards and Warriors, which is a short-lived show from the early 80s with Jeff Conaway and Julia Duffy, which
yeah.
is a lot of fun.
Never heard of that one.
It's a fun one. It only ran for like 7 or 8 episodes. It was kind of a comedy, fantasy, Dungeons and Dragons-y kind of thing, but a bit silly. And the great thing, too, not only do you get Monique, but you get Bo Brundon, who is the older gentleman who's sitting at the radio all the time. And he is the killer in Headless Eyes.
So that was Otto.
Yes, yes.
Okay.
Whoever, yeah. When Jeffrey Bog first get led into the hideout, you see the older gentleman with the beard mustache, gray beard mustache, on the radio with Monique, and that's Bo Brundon from Headless Eyes. And Headless Eyes just came out on Blu-ray. Everybody, if you're interested,
I've not seen that yet.
You haven't seen Headless Eyes? I recommend it. It's a good early 70s sleazy sort of. It's one of those follow the psycho around. It's not like like a Maniac or Don't Go in the House kind of thing or Psycho. But I recommend it. But that has nothing to do with Voyagers, you Voyager fans. Oh, it does actually. No, well, it's funny to see the credits where it's like Bo Brundon. And I was like, wait a minute. The guy from Headless Eyes, Monique Van de Ven. I was like, what? Who else is going to be in this? Oh, my God. Is Sorcery going to be playing somewhere? Oh, my God.
That would have been perfect.
Oh, my God. I am the Prince of Darkness. It's a great movie, everyone. You saw it on the big screen, right, Amy?
Yes, it was amazing.
Yeah. Was that your first time?
It was. It was the most fun. I couldn't believe how much fun this movie was.
Yeah, mine too. What was it? It was like 8 or 9 years ago now. I saw it in a double feature with The Apple, the strange musical from the end of the 70s, early 80s. And Stunt Rock is just so much fun. It's tough to describe because it is exactly what it says, Stunt Rock.
Yep.
But And it's just, it's so much fun. Oh, boy. You know, it's like I've seen that film so many times. But that's another podcast, Amy. Amy, you can join me sometime, maybe for a Dan's Drive-In double feature.
I would love it.
We can talk Stunt Rock, and we'll pick out another crazy film from that time period that you enjoy. We'll do that. We'll do that,
that
sometime.
Awesome.
So, and when Voyagers is done, Amy will return next in a Dan's Drive-In double feature doing Stunt Rock. That would be great.
It would be.
All right. So, what did you think of Pursuit?
I thought it was kind of a dense episode. It was like a lot to take in and a lot to try to summarize.
Yeah, really. I was proud of you. I was very proud of you. I would still be summarizing.
I try to keep it short. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot going on in this episode,
I think for the only time so far, you get it's bookended with the wrong timeline and the correct timeline, but then the 35 to 40 minutes of the episode, you're in the same space. You don't hop anywhere. You don't go. I think that's the only time that's really happened. Because normally you get at least one moment where like they would have leapt into somewhere or other in the center for like 10 or 15 minutes. So because of that, I think it just makes the there has to be more to it. The writing, you can't sort of bring it to a point where suddenly you can jump away for 15 minutes into something else, like a short piece. You have to, and it is very dense. There are a lot of discussions of traitors and you know, like that. There's that one guy who keeps insisting they go to the Russians instead of the Americans, and.
Yeah, I was pretty sure he was the traitor, but you know, I'm not good at reading people, I guess.
I it was one of those things. Just looking at the crowd, I knew it wasn't Werner there, but I had no idea who it was. I was just like, I have no clue who the jerk might be here. Yeah. I actually didn't think it was her. The way they do it is, they're in this apartment, and she sits down at the radio, and she's giving the relaying all the information into the radio, and then it cuts to sort of another room behind a curtain, and Bog and Kurt are sort of in front of the curtain watching her. Then Bog turns around to get something out of a bag. He opens the curtain, leans in, and sees the crystal thing, and suddenly you turn. It's like, oh my God, she's the traitor. And it was like, I actually did not expect that one. That's a Meyerson. And in fact, Alan Meyerson, he does a really good job with the action in this, which is weird because Police Academy 5, which he directed, I have some problems with the slapstick in that. But I didn't even realize when I wrote down his name. I was like, oh my gosh, it's Simon Miami Beach. My brother and I went to see that opening weekend.
Hilarious.
Okay, let's see. You just hit a few more points here. Let's see. I do like Wally's Gas and Aerospace Museum.
Yeah, he was a pretty entertaining character. I'm glad they let him do. He was Exposition Steve in this one. So
yeah, he really was Exposition Steve in it. And there is something. It was interesting, like that opening montage of basically like U.S. blows it and screwing it up again. You know,
it went on for a couple of minutes. I was surprised.
It did because it for a split second right at the beginning you think it's going to go normal, but then it just starts to go worse and worse and worse, and it's sort of there was that thing in what was it, Dr. No, in the first James Bond film, was blowing up our rockets when they were leaving Cape Canaveral. And then there was an Italian James Bond ripoff called Lightning Bolt with Anthony Isley from 66, which is the exact same plot. They're launching rockets and jerks are blowing them up. So that was kind of a big thing. And I thought about those movies as I was watching it. I do like my favorite headline. Do you know what my favorite headline is?
I don't.
Rocket Fizzle. Which I'm in. I don't know what to tell you. And I did look it up. The Kemmler, or the head Nazi, he was a real guy.
Oh, okay.
And he actually did hold Von Braun, and all those people in Austria there, right at the end of the war. And it was more or less, and I just read this morning, I'm sorry, I might get some of this wrong, but it was more or less he was holding them there as the Americans were advancing, and Von Braun did something like he Kemmler had them all sort of in one place, and Von Braun said, "You should spread us out because the Americans are about to show up, and it'll be tougher for them to find us." And so Kemmler said, "Okay," because he was at the end of his rope. He split them all up, and then Von Braun, the people he was with, immediately took off and got to the Americans. And so that's the way.
Good thinking on Von Braun's or Von Braun's.
I do like the there's the moment where the soldier pulls the gun on the guy that Jeffrey goes out with when the soldier pulls a gun on him. Ernst, yes, it pulls a gun on him. He's and suddenly Jeffrey realizes that the soldier, it's an American soldier. And he's like, "Oh, but you're American? I am." Well, he doesn't talk like that.
I'm from Sheboygan.
I'm from Sheboygan, yeah. It's like, "Jeffrey Jones, New York, New York. I'm Fred Schnecker," or something like that. Sheboygan, and this is the craziest thing I've ever heard. It's like, and I love the fact that because presumably now, as this is happening, the timeline is being fixed. So presumably there is a gentleman named Fred who probably 40, 50 years on down the line or something. Maybe he takes a trip with his family. "Dad, we're going to take you somewhere you've never been. New York, New York." "Oh, I'd love to go there. I've never been." And they take him to New York, New York, and he's wandering around. And then all of a sudden, this little kid in a red striped sweater, a shirt goes by. He's like, "Is that Jeffrey Jones from New York, New York?" And it's the temporal possibilities.
Exactly. Fiction possibility too.
Yes. Oh my gosh. I think that final sequence with the gas and everything is really nicely done. It's fairly epic looking. Now maybe the guy sticking his head out the window yelling, "Here come the Americans, we got it the first time." But I think the rest of it's pretty nicely done.
Yeah, there are realistic explosions for, not being explosions.
Yeah, exactly. And for, if you know your back lots, they're on a back lot here, but it's okay. I mean, I don't think when I was 9 or 10, I would never have known that. Now it's just cool to me that they were able to pull off so much of this stuff on the back lots and everything. I did have one thought. You know where I thought they were going to zap to another place? Here's what I thought was going to happen, and bear with me just for a minute, and then we can come back to your final thoughts on this. And I just will say, did you notice that there were certain times when the Nazis were rounding people up? And all I have written here, I should have written more. I wrote a note: the goofy yelling Nazis. And I think there were bits where they were like rounding people up, and they were like, "Over here, stand here, 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 stand here, over here." And they were just yelling over and over again. And it was like, "What, guys, come on. Is this really how you took over so much of Europe, by yelling like idiots the whole
time?"
Yeah,
it doesn't seem likely.
Here's what I thought was going to happen, and this could all be part of our vast, fan fiction network that we're going to create when we're all done here. I thought what was going to happen was there are like a half a dozen scientists in this room when the Nazis find them, and Jeffrey and Bog are in there too. And so they're all going to rush out. This is the scene where Bog beats the crap out of every single Nazi in Austria, which is pretty cool. I thought what was going to happen is that as the door is like finally being broken through, and they're like, "We're never going to be able to get out in time," da da, something like this, all of a sudden Jeffrey yells, "Everyone join hands," and they all join hands, and Bog is kind of standing there. Bog says, "What's going on? Take my hand." And they're all standing there, and Jeffrey goes, "Bog, what?" And Jeffrey looks at the Omni, and Bog goes, "Oh!" And all of a sudden the door crashes open, and Bog says something like, "Where to? Wherever." The Nazis storm in with guns. Bog touches the Omni, and the whole line of like eight people vanish.
I would have liked that.
That's what I thought. And then they go somewhere. I mean, I thought, it could be somewhere like maybe the first Olympics. When were the first the first modern Olympics? Were like an early 20th century or something like that.
Yeah,
like in Rome
19...
or something.
Yeah, something like that.
Something like, you have like the country enter, like Poland, maybe Poland because we're wacky. You see like Hungary and the people enter, with the big sign. Poland and the people enter with a big sign. And then another country begins to come in, and all of a sudden like eight people just drop in between. two of the nations. And they all kind of look around, and everyone's looking at them, like, where are we? Don't ask. Join hands again. Where are we going? And they go back to the camp or something like that.
See, that would have been good.
My other thought was, and this wouldn't have actually worked for a kid's thing, is that could you imagine, you see da 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 da, and you see whoosh, whoosh, and then you see Bog on the left flying towards us through the tunnel, Jeffrey in the middle, maybe Monique there on the side, maybe Werner in there too. And then as they fly overhead, you see like a kite, like the tail of a kite, like all these people joining hands flying overhead. And then it cuts to, here we go. And then we'll wrap it up, folks, because I'm yakking here. Then we cut to, and this was the version we couldn't have done. We cut to, you see a vast crowd of people, and you see a stage. And all of a sudden you hear on electric guitar the Star Spangled Banner start to be played. And all of a sudden you see a bunch of kind of half-naked, dirty hippies who are stoned out of their minds. And then all of a sudden, eight people, a really good-looking guy, like an 11, 12-year-old kid, and like six Austrian scientists drop into the center of this crowd of hippies. And they're like, whoa, dude, what's going on? Don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. Where are we? We're in Woodstock. Don't worry about it. Just take your hands. What is this place? Where are we? What is that noise? Oh, that's Jimi Hendrix. And they all get entranced by him. And all the hippies are like coming around going, man, I am so high. What is happening? And then they zoop out of there at the last second. But then I thought of that this morning as I was on my walk. And then I thought, you can't do that. It's a kid's show. I mean, you could do Woodstock, because that would be an important thing, but I don't think you could. The theory that none of the hippies would have acknowledged it because they all thought they were high may not have worked. But I thought, if you were to insert a zoop away in right there, I just love the thought of the Nazis are about to break in. Maybe the Nazis are coming in the back door too. They're completely trapped. And they're like, what do we do? It's over. It's done. And Jeffrey suddenly yells, everyone join hands. Like, what? Take my hand. Join hands. And then you just get this row of people joining hands with Bog sort of in the middle going, the Omni. Oh, yes. And they're out of there. So that would have been the spot where I would have had them travel away.
I think that would have worked.
Wouldn't that be fun? I think we come up with a lot of great ideas for what future Voyager seasons could have been if they reboot Voyagers.
Oh, man. Really? They should.
It's not going to be the same, I don't
think. It's not. I mean, but still. It's such a great premise. Time travel hasn't been done before, we know. But
but this one, I think is a very, good premise, I think, because it's so exciting. It's so much fun. It's so rambunctious, but and also you learn. I mean,
you do.
I learned about Von Braun. I learned about this jerk Nazi guy here.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, whenever we get to the end of the episode, and it's been a really good episode, and Jeffrey says, if you want to learn about da da da, it's all in books. Go to the library. I tear up almost every time. that's just me. So, I mean, we could have a new Voyagers with Mino. He's alive and well, and he's a photographer.
Yeah.
We could have him being the head Voyager, picking up somehow, like, you know, a younger Voyager.
Yeah, I mean, I that would work.
That would be fantastic.
But then there would be a sad story about, you know, where's Phineas Fogg? You'd have to address it.
Oh gosh. Yep. I don't even want to get near that yet. That might be something we discuss at the very end.
Yeah.
But that's nothing we're going to discuss now, because that technically was a short-lived show, but that's all I'll say. So, okay, all right, you got my big spiel there. I'm going to stop talking. Anything else about this one, Amy?
No, I mean, I think we covered it for, cool. You know, for what it was. I enjoyed it. It was a good episode, I thought. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, you learned something. You know, it was exciting.
And it filled with the structure a bit, just to show that they can do an episode like this in future.
Yeah, you got to wonder if they're still trying to develop the show at this point, like figure out what works and what doesn't. Because, I mean, things change a little bit as the seasons go on, and the whole setup of this episode was a little different than others, especially with the beginning. And like you said, you spend a big chunk of time at the one jump in the middle.
Yes.
And just bookended by just others.
Like sort of a regular drama almost. I wonder if they were planning on doing it. Well, we won't know now. Well, maybe, you know. Hey, you know, when I finished the cliffhangers discussion, Kenneth Johnson had some nice things to say to me. And so maybe we'll, maybe James Perriott's floating around and we can ask him if he had any
Wouldn't
ideas.
That be amazing?
That would be awesome. So, all right. Amy, where can we find you online?
You can find me on Instagram at Amy_the_conqueror.
Yes. All right. Well, I gotta take off. I gotta do a little rocket fizzle, but I'll be back for next time, everybody. Stay cool. Talk to you soon.
This man has a singular advantage over other men. Ben Richards is immune to every known disease, including old age. Periodic transfusions of his blood can give other men a second, a third lifetime, perhaps more.
Find Ben Richards!
The effects of a transfusion are only temporary. I must therefore control Ben Richards' life permanently.
He's the most valuable man in the world, but he's no good to me dead.
His brother may have the same kind of blood. We've got to find him before Richards does.
If you had million-dollar blood, where would you hide?
I didn't ask for this. I was a test driver. I liked the job. One day the doctor told me I had some kind of special blood. I don't understand it. But I know this. Everything they're offering, I don't want. I gotta live free.
Legacy. Originally aired October 15th, 1970. Directed by Robert Douglas. Written by Bob and Wanda Duncan. Hey, it's Bob and Wanda, everybody. This feels like a Duncan. It really does. So, this one begins with our good friend Ben in his car. He's getting a water pump replaced, and it's going to take a few hours. He's in a place called Rio Seco. I think that's Rio Seco. Sound like different people made it sound like they were saying it in different ways. So that's Rio Seco. And within 1 minute, he sees the black car with Maitland's goons in it. These are new goons, one of them whom has the most fake. How do I want to describe him? He's a good man. He has the fakest, most real mustache you'll ever see, which I really got a kick out of. And they chase him around a bit, and they chase him through this really great, I don't know where this location is. They've had some fun locations in this show, but it looks like a series of houses are being repaired or something, and they're up on blocks or like boathouses or something, because they're just these houses, small houses in the middle of this field, and they're all on blocks, so they're all like 3 or 4 feet off the ground, and it's Ben kind of like hides underneath one and kind of stands up in it, and it's a little weird but fun. And he ends up in the back of a truck under a cloth, and the truck is being driven by a woman named Annie Simpson Williams, who is played by Susan Howard. Everybody loves Susan Howard, of course. Donna Krebs, or Donna, I forget what her maiden name was in Dallas, but she's a lot of fun in this, and she's traveling with a young boy named Luis, and going to Luis's just had some schooling, and she's taking Luis back to his home, which is in a mine. And they sort of stop, there's a bit of driving away from the bad guys, and they sort of stop in the middle of nowhere, and Ben's been shot, kind of grazed in the arm, and she stops to take care of his arm, and they have a little chat.
Well, thank you.
Look, if you'll sit down, I'll take a look at your shoulder.
It's nothing.
Sit down, please.
Hi.
What I saw before, I think it's going to need a tourniquet. Bleeding's practically stopped. That's not possible. I'd still better put something on it.
I don't get it.
Get what?
Well, free ride, free treatment, no questions.
You complaining?
No.
If you wanted me to know, you'd tell me. If you didn't, you'd lie.
You work in Rio Seco?
Temporarily. I'm one of those dedicated volunteers you read about. Teach the Chicano children, listen to the old folks tell me the troubles. And I tell them to wait and be patient, and things are bound to get better.
Will they?
No. That's why little Annie Simpson Williams is turning in her torch. Just didn't take.
So they bring Luis back to this mine where his grandfather is and all these other folks who are working on the mine. And she brings him in and they meet the head guy, Ramos. And things don't go that well.
Coming to school down at Rio Seco.
Oh, get out of here. Get out of here before I tan your hide. Go!
Look, wait a minute. This young lady's a school teacher, and all she did was bring some medical supplies.
If we need medical supplies, we'll get them ourselves. The boy shouldn't have been bothering you. I'll see to it doesn't happen again.
He doesn't like, obviously, Luis going off and getting an education. He thinks, I guess the legacy, as it were, is to stay at the mine. And we learn a moment later that Grandpa is very sick. And he apparently has typhoid, which isn't so great. And Ramos says, okay, we'll go get a doctor for him. And they quarantine off the place. And, or the sort of house that he's in. And, you know, Ben and Annie are a little worried. Ramos doesn't seem terribly worried. And Annie goes out to talk to Luis after she's learned, after they've all learned that Grandpa may be dying.
What's the matter, Luis?
He says I made the old man sick.
Who says?
Gomez. He works in the mine.
Just how are you supposed to have made your grandfather sick?
He said I had no business going out to school down there. He said the old man got sick just so I would be punished.
And who's doing the punishing?
El Señor.
God?
Yes.
Will you listen to me if I tell you something? We think your grandfather has typhoid fever. Now, we could have caught it from drinking polluted water, or he might have caught it from somebody who was carrying the disease.
But why him? Why not somebody else?
I can't answer that. But God isn't punishing you for getting an education, Luis, for making something of yourself. Your grandfather agreed to it, remember?
Then maybe it's because I was thinking of leaving here for good.
After the doctor comes, and when your grandfather's feeling better, I'll talk to him about it.
Do you really think a doctor's gonna come?
What do you mean?
Nothing.
Ramos ends up not bringing a doctor in, and the grandfather dies, and everyone's a little unhappy, and some folks are worried about the typhoid spreading, and we learn that Ramos is in charge of everything, and as you heard in that last scene, he kind of keeps everyone there working in the mine through a mixture of guilt and goons who have guns. And so Ramos is the only one who has a car. He's the only one who can travel anywhere. And his plan is this, that the mine owners have sort of abandoned the mine. They don't think there's enough ore in it. Now, I'm not 100% sure what the ore is. I never wrote it down. That's sort of a Duncan thing. They like to leave some of these things kind of vague. It's a Duncan. But Ramos is convinced, well, they need to, like, something 10 tons worth of ore, and the mine is terrible. I mean, the thing is about to collapse, and they've got 2 days until they get enough, and they can go to the mine owners and get lots of money for it, getaway money, as one guy calls it. Susan wants to stay and help as much as she can, and we learn that Luis is a great illustrator, and Luis wants to go into school. He wants to do a life there, but they're guilting the crap out of him to stay behind, especially with the death of his grandfather. And Ben wants to leave to try to bring a doctor in because the typhoid could be spreading. That's the point where Ramos basically takes Ben hostage, more or less, and says, we need 2 days to clear this out, and you're not going anywhere. And for the next 15, 20 minutes of the episode, everywhere, Ben tries to escape, but there are too many of them. And there's just a guy who stands there with a gun, pointing a gun at him all the time, and every once in a while, he has a chat with Annie. Did I call her Susan a moment ago? I'm probably going to call her both. She's the only woman in the episode, I think, and Annie falls for Ben pretty hard, especially because of the sort of way when Grandpa is infected. You know, he says, everybody out, I'll stay with him. And she, I think she says something like, the problem with heroes is that they always think they're immune to everything. And then we think, wink, wink. So she's kind of fallen for Ben, but Ben's got to keep on rambling. The reason why he's in this area in the first place is the Adams Ranch, where he and his brother used to go when they were young, is nearby, and he's trying to get there. And things kind of build to a point where Ramos finally agrees to let Luis go and tells Luis he should go, and immediately Luis gets the typhoid. And he is going to die. And Ramos says, no, we're not going to get a doctor. We've got like a day left, and we'll be able to get out of here. And Ben sort of grabs explosives and goes into the mine and has a standoff with Ramos. And at that same time, the guy with the big fake real mustache and his pal show up and begin to sort of coerce to get Ben out here. And there's all sorts of chicanery and a car chase and everything like that. And cars end up at the bottom of canyons. And the two jerks, Ben sort of strands them out in the middle of nowhere and heads back to the mine and realizes that he's got to get out of there now. And basically at that point, they're going to... he does finally convince... Ramos to get a doctor and bring a doctor in. Doctor shows up and inoculates everyone, so everyone should be okay. Luis is going to be okay. He's going to go off and do his thing. Ramos is going to quit being so he's very, what's the angle? What's the angle? You know, the hustle. He's about the hustle and the angle. And Ben says, you don't have to do that all the time. There are nice people out here. And it ends with Luis going to the town to get his education. And Annie, giving Ben a few kisses and saying, maybe this will bring you back here sometime. And Ben gives Ramos his car because he said, they know my car now. I can't use it. And the episode ends with Ramos. The episode ends with some smooches between Annie and Ben. Ramos and Ben shaking hands. And we see Ben in a bus leaving. And that's the end of the legacy. And it's, again, like the last episode, it's a good episode. You know, I was trying to think, I was talking to myself when I was out for my walk this morning. And occasionally people look at me like I'm crazy. But I try to sort of work, are shows like this, would they have tried to make, were they shooting for great, or were they just shooting for good and hoping people would tune in? Because I would say this is a good episode. It's a little padded out with some discussions between, some moments between Ramos and Ben, and some moments between Ben and Annie sort of go circular on us. And I I'm watching these from old sci-fi things, and the episode's about 46 minutes, so there's probably about four or five minutes cut out of this. So I'm wondering if it were full length, would I be thinking it was a little on the dull side? But as it goes, there's enough back and forth and trying to convince Ramos to snap out of it, and you know, and of course there's stuff, you know, where, hey, it's this, you know, it's this one tiny white woman coming to this camp, and everyone at the camp is Mexican. And there is sort of the and I'm not going to go too deep into that, but there is the thing of, you know, oh gosh, one white woman shows up and she's going to show all of us, you know, how to take care of ourselves and how to live a better life. Thank you, but no thank you. And she is helping Luis, though, and Ben can see that. And there's the typhoid thing, which is, it's funny because Annie's a teacher and Ben's a test driver, and they recognize typhoid like that, and they know how it works, and they know this, the sort of when they see it, and it's really, I've never encountered typhoid. So I don't know if it's something like a test driver would see and go, oh my gosh, that's typhoid. But they diagnose it so quickly that you think they're doctors for a moment. And this brings up a point in the episode, something that kind of, I don't know if it confused me, but made me wonder for a moment. And this point is actually echoed in our Manimal discussion. The previous episode was involved the Ben and his blood and all that kind of thing, and a lot of the bad guys. The one before that with Ross Martin didn't so much, but it was a really lovely episode. So I didn't really think about it. But this one, it's weird. If you take out sort of the opening and you make it, say, like Richard Kimball or Dr. Banner from The Incredible Hulk hiding from somebody in this car and then going to this place and doing all this stuff, and then whoever was after them finding them in the place, I'm wondering if this was an episode possibly of something that was maybe written, maybe the Duncans wrote it for The Fugitive or something, and it sort of got bumped or it was rejected, and then they saw The Immortal and they rewrote it for The Immortal, because there's really nothing in the episode apart from You know what makes me even think more than it might have been a Fugitive episode? What I just said about him diagnosing the typhoid so quickly. That's like a Dr. Richard Kim. That would be a thing a doctor would do. Like Dr. Richard Kimball. Oh my gosh. Wow. Okay. I'm liking my theory more and more as I'm saying it. But I'm wondering, yeah, if this was for another show, a similar show, and they just rewrote bits of it to make it more of The Immortal. Because apart from the wound healing on his arm rather quickly, the sort of flesh wound, I guess it's a flesh wound. I can't imagine his blood like dissolves the bullet, because there's no, after she checks his arm and kind of pats it with some antiseptic because she's bringing medical supplies there, after she does that, there's sort of no mention of his arm being shot again, having a bullet in it, so it must be just grazed. But apart from that, the healing moment with that, and apart from him saying that he'll stay in the room with the grandpa, and she's like, oh, well, she's, like I said, the line about heroes, but you know, again, wink, that he, the typhoid won't affect him. And so there are a few moments like that where he seems a little unconcerned about being infected by the typhoid, but that's it. I mean, apart from obviously the goons in the beginning and the end, and not Ramos's goons, Maitland's goons, there's no reference at all to the blood and his immortality, which seems strange because I thought what was going to happen, first when the grandfather was dying and then when Luis was infected, was he was going to say, I mean, I would imagine in those medical supplies there must be some sort of hypodermic or something. I don't fully know how blood transfusions work. I mean, but I thought he was going to say, get a hypodermic, take some of my blood and put some of that blood in Grandpa, or put some of that blood in Luis, and that would have cured him in an instant. But it doesn't even seem to occur to him to say that in the episode. He could have saved the Grandpa when they're all standing around. They're going, well, where's the doctor? Where's the doctor? He'll be here. He'll be here. Where's the doctor? He'll be here. Where's the doctor? He's not coming. Grandpa's dead. Oh, dear. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, it's just a strange thing. You think he would have used his blood, but he never does, and that's it. It makes for weirdness in the episode, because inoculation of his blood into everyone would presumably keep them from getting the typhoid. But the whole thing is about, like, everyone's going to come down with typhoid, but we need two more days, and so it's a weird bit of plotting that makes me think that this episode was not an immortal episode. Now, hey, I'm talking about it on this podcast. It is truly immortal now, my friends. No, sorry. What was I saying about the immortal? Yeah, I mean, it's a good episode. It's the location of this mine is really great, and they do a lot of walking around it, and it's funny. It's sort of the scheme seems slightly madcap to me that the mine company has said, no, this mine's played out, but all the miners stayed and are accumulating stuff from the mine, and they say like their getaway money or stuff, but if the mine company still owns it, right? So it's still all the mine company's ore, isn't it? If they go to sell it to the company, I got a little confused here and there, because if they go to sell it to the company and there's enough of it, can a company just say, oh, thank you very much, you just mined all of this for free, we'll take it from here? I don't know, maybe Ramos doesn't have it figured out as well as he should. Yeah, it's like I said, it's a good episode, not a great episode. My favorite is still the one with Ross Martin. I love the writing in that. I love the camaraderie in that. You know, and Susan Howard is great in this. I always like her in everything, so she's lovely to see. And yeah, the guy who plays Ramos is very good, and Luis is fun, and it's a good episode of The Immortal. And hey, sound clips, everybody. What did you think of that? Were you surprised? Huh? Come on. Tell me you were surprised. Hey, I thought it was great. So, yeah, that's kind of the legacy. With an episode like this, there's not too much to really say. But let me just take a moment. I'm going to look at my notes. Maybe there's something I can come up with. The only thing I came up with is they really push the angle that everyone at the mine is Mexican. And you heard that in the clip where they arrive and Ramos says, get out of here before I tan you behind, or whatever it is he says. Because that, it's like they're not going into a village or a town or something. They're going to this old ratty mine, and that music is playing and playing. We're like, we get it. We got it. Okay, we got it. They're Mexican. We got it. It seemed like they were kind of gilding the lily just a touch on that one. But that's the kind of thing that happens. It was 1970. So, yeah, that's The Immortal, everyone. And I just want to say, and then I'll go, and we'll kick in the next segment. But Donna and Ray got a raw deal on Dallas. I think I talk about this everywhere where I talk about Dallas. But they were having troubles on again, off again throughout, what is it, season 8. Then season 9 starts, and suddenly they're in love. They're adopting a child. They're building a house in South Fork. The season ends. Someone, it looks like Bobby, is in the shower. Season 10 begins, and suddenly everything rolls back, and they're not going to adopt a child because that didn't happen, and they're not going to build a house because that didn't happen. And at the end of season 8, they were sort of at the end of their tether, and they rebuild. And unfortunately, when the episodes roll back, they're at the end of their tether again, and this time they don't make it, which is awful. But then, this is later on, I think Ray marries Priscilla Presley. So that ain't half bad. But you don't want the ghost of Elvis after you. So it's just a little tangent. So that is episode 4 of The Immortal, The Legacy. And, this one didn't have too much sort of variation for where I thought the show would go. So I'm interested, as always, to see what the next one will do, if it sort of brings the Immortal more into it, the Immortal plot line, or whether it's one of these sort of one-off dramas. But let's, enough of my yakking, let's get on to the next segment.
Thank you. animal.
Bark, bark! I miss Glenn Turbin! Bark!
We all do, Polly. We all do. Was that Polly? Was that Polly or Manimal want a cracker?
Polly's sad.
Oh, I miss Glenn Turbin too. Now we do like Michael Roberts.
We do. We love Michael Roberts.
We do love Michael Roberts, but Glenn Turbin brought a little more I don't know, slightly more sophistication than Michael Roberts might do during the limbo scene.
I almost thought it was more more comedic myself, but we're getting ahead of ourselves here.
Yeah, folks, we are here discussing the third episode of Glenn A. Larson's Night of the Scorpion. Manimal. It's called Night of the Scorpion. Sorry, I'm looking. I've got it written down in front of me here. Too many notes, people. Too many notes. Manimal, Episode 3, Night of the Scorpion. Aired October 21st, 1983. Let's see. I would have been... I think that was the year... That was the year at Halloween. Oh, wait a minute. Did the next one air before Halloween? I'll tell a story before the next one.
I was seven. That's all I know.
I was ten, and I do remember what happened to me. Something that hurt happened to me right before Halloween. But we'll talk about it during.
You realize Glenn Turbin wasn't coming back, and you're like, oh.
I mean, that hurt in an emotional way. This was more in like a pain in the ass kind of way.
Ooh, ouch.
So this episode is Night of the Scorpion, written by Glenn A. Larson and directed by Daniel Haller. And before we begin anything, I just want to say hi to you, Charlie. Can I call you Chuck during this episode?
You can call me... what's that song? Al.
Al?
You can call me Al. Yeah, you can call me Al.
If you let me call you Chuck, you can call me Peppermint Patty.
Damn right, Peppermint Patty. Double so P. Things are excellent. Things are fantastic, and you can call me whatever you would like, sir. Things are good. I'm assuming we're in the summer?
We are in the summer. Yep,
in the throes of summer.
Yes, we are. Where we are right now. We might record this a little ahead of time, folks. Where we are right now, we're around early July.
Ah, what a beautiful summer it's been so far.
Hasn't it been?
The things that I did on June 30th. Other than that, life's been pretty great.
Good.
Haven't been doing a whole much outside of just hanging around the house and hanging with my family.
Yeah.
Which is great. It was perfect springtime fun.
Awesome. Yeah.
Lots of water being thrown around and goofiness.
Good. Just chicanery. Just general shenanigans.
Yes, just madness. Absolute madness. Well, what about you? How are you doing?
I'm doing all right. Yeah. You know, summer isn't my absolute favorite time of the year. I prefer, I'm a more of a winter guy. But it's
just straight up winter.
Yeah, wow, sort of. Okay. Yeah. But we have just celebrated the first anniversary of eventually Super Train. So that's
Woo-hoo!
Fun. We started, the first episode went up. I said it earlier, what was it, around July 4th or so is when the first episode went up. So it's nice. I'm glad you're part of it.
I'm glad. I'm stoked to be here. You put up so many episodes. My podcast listening is even less frequent than my podcast recording. So unfortunately, I'm probably 40 episodes behind, but I know there's a ton of content there, and it must be good because lots of our friends miss the segment you were just doing with
1 Minute with Night of Horror.
Yeah, Vaughn was sad to see it go, I believe.
Yeah, I'm going to do – I actually, you know, folks, right around when you're listening to this, there may be a new 1 Minute of something starting up. Yes.
1 Minute of Teen Wolf.
Oh, my gosh. That would be fun. We should do that because that's coming out
minute
in Blu-ray.
By minute. Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah.
That'd be, and we could even do if it would be easier. Some folks do like 5 minutes at a time. Like there's a new Superman one coming out.
Oh yeah.
They do 5 minutes at a time rather than one.
Yeah, just that because, makes more sense.
Just because when you if it's just me sitting here like a jackass talking about Night of Horror.
Yeah.
I can do one at a time, and I was surprised at how many people listen to 1 minute of Night of Horror. And when I would say stuff like, "Oh, we're getting up to the part where they go on the quest for the skull," and they'd be like, "Don't tell me, I haven't seen it." And I was like, whoa,
like they were waiting there.
Yeah, they didn't know what the movie was. They were waiting to, and so I actually had not quite a few but several people say, "I'm gonna watch the movie after you finish." I was like, I'm kind of honored because
that is honor.
I mean, apart from last year at Marion Bad, or that one French film, what is it, Jeanne Dumont 23 something or other, that 3.5 hour long film about a woman just going through her day, making dinner and just eating and sitting around, that where nothing happens in the movie. Apart from that, I need to find the name of that movie. Apart from that, nothing happens less in a movie than in Night of Horror.
Well, that other thing you just described of watching a woman go around sounds like the kind of thing some people pay for to watch. So.
Oh, that's true. Yeah. Yeah.
On the dark webs.
Oh, my gosh. Well, Criterion just put that out on Blu-ray.
Huh.
So that has cred in a way that Night of Horror sadly does not.
I never fully understood the Criterion cred, but I don't know if that's for a conversation.
Yeah, that might be kind of... We can continue... stay tuned for the next segment for more on Criterion cred. Right now... I think it'd be fun.
wet my whistle.
I'm going to read us the Night of the Scorpion, the full unabridged production synopsis from the booklet.
Perfect.
And it'll take about 2 to 3 minutes. I'm going to go through it relatively quickly, but this is the full plot from beginning to end with spoilers.
With spoilers.
Yes.
So, yeah, you've had, 23 years?
Yeah, this was October 21st, 1983. You've had 33 years.
Oh, my goodness. I do math for a living.
34 years. Do you?
I do. I genuinely
Wait a minute.
Do.
Wait a minute, my day job is math, too.
Yeah, I hate math so much.
Oh, my God, it hurts.
Math is the reason why I was a super senior. I had to go back to high school for half a season or half a semester or whatever it is solely to take math to graduate.
I gave up during calculus during my senior year of high school when they started teaching us imaginary numbers. I literally one day I just threw up my hands and said, I can't handle this anymore. Imaginary numbers, I'm gone. I'm done.
This ain't Mr. Rogers' house.
This is today we're going to discuss the number I. And I said, I'm out of here. This is the end of this.
This is the number circle.
What? And my final calculus test, I didn't answer any of the questions. I just listed multiplication tables and like geometric things that I knew and said, this all makes sense to me. I can't figure out.
You're testing me on this, but I want to talk about this.
Yes, exactly. And the teacher was disappointed, but we only needed 3 years of math and I'd already done 3.5. So I was like, I could back out. So, I mean, we want to talk about Manimal, which is awesome.
How about Mathimal?
Mathimal.
That could have been you, Mathimal.
I could have turned into a giant number 3. That's like Electric Company or
just
something.
A giant Texas Instruments. Anyways, just don't push my buttons.
Night of the Scorpion. Now, is it... we go to the Bahamas in this. Is it Nassau? Is that how it's pronounced? Or Nassau?
Nassau.
Nassau? Okay.
I believe so. Nassau?
Because I will say Nassau in the Bahamas.
I am Canadian, though, so like you can't, you know.
Oh, that's true. I'm going to follow your lead, though, because I know Nassau from Thunderball, the James Bond film, which is a fantastic film.
Tom Jones does that song, doesn't he?
He does. Yeah. Thunderball!
I don't know if you know this. I'm a huge Tom Jones fan, like always have been.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, massive. I drove 12 hours one way to see him live.
Oh, my God. I used to be able to... It's not unusual to be loved by anyone. I used to do it better than that, but...
The saddest part about him seeing him live was that song he did, like, in a medley. So you didn't even get, like... The song's only a minute and a half long. Like, you know, like... So it only got, like, 45 seconds of it was a super bummer, but...
I don't want to know. That here, 2 episodes from now, everyone... We're going to do something called Continuing Tom Jones, where we hear more about the Tom Jones.
Well, I'll tell you more. I'll tell you all about my adventures with Tom Jones.
Okay, that'll be before, give me a second, before High Stakes. And yes. I know Tracy Scoggins is in that one, so you want to get to that as quick as you can, if I remember correctly.
Well, I would be as quick as I can, but anyways.
Oh, boy.
Night of the Scorpion, you say.
Nassau businessman Michael Sloan is found dead in his cruise ship stateroom. The initial blame falls upon an exotic tarantula being shipped to Jonathan from the Bahamas. However, Jonathan is able to prove that Sloan's death was caused by a lethal reaction to a sophisticated truth serum used by the intelligence community. Oh boy. With leads left behind by Sloan for his daughter Terry, Jonathan takes his investigation team to the Bahamas, where they find much more than a puzzling $2 million Sloan left for Terry. Our group also finds that Sloan was in business as a cover for his real activity, that as an agent for the CIA. Jonathan learns that it was the Russian KGB who killed Sloan with the truth serum, as they tried to force him to give up a list of highly placed KGB agents working in the U.S. government. The big surprise comes when Jonathan discovers that Sloan's partner, Arnie Sipes, is Doug McClure. No, actually, that's not what it says. It says discovers
that Sloan's... That's who he is!
Oh, I love... We could talk about how much I love Doug McClure in a minute.
best if we all register in my name. That way no one will know that we're here, right?
Terry Sloan.
So much for that plan.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sure you barely recognize me. Only about 10 when I passed through Cleveland with your father. Arnold Sipes.
Oh, of course. Oh, I'm sorry, Professor Chase. Mr. Earl. This is Arnold Sipes, my father's partner.
Glad to meet you.
How do you do?
How do you do? I hope you know how devastated we all are by the news.
Tell me, how did you know that Miss Sloan was arriving today? Quite frankly, we're trying to keep her presence here as quiet as possible.
Oh, Michael, that is, her father told me to be expecting her. There's no great problem to check with the airlines. The visitors' cards are a matter of public record. And naturally, you'll stay at the house with Mildred and me?
Well, that's a very generous offer, Mr. Sipes, but you see, I work for the New York Police Department, and because of the nature of her father's death, we intend to keep Terry under tight security.
Well, if I can't invite you to the country, at least let me offer you the best meal in town.
Well,
it's a private club. She'll be quite safe there.
Well, put like that, how could I possibly refuse? Thank you.
Done. Now, you check in, and I'll phone ahead.
Was that smart?
Well, we came here for some answers. Two men who've been in partnership for 15 years must know something about each other.
Discovers that Sloan's partner, Arnie Sipes, S-I-P-E-S, so anagram that, folks. Arnie Sipes is a double agent working for the KGB, and his name is at the top of the list. While both Sipes and the Russians are after the same list, it's Jonathan, with help from Ty, who discovers the list... Wait a minute. Who discovers the key to the list's whereabouts. There's some strange punctuation in the booklet, folks. I apologize.
It was written by a real manimal.
Yes, it really was. It's not a mathimal. A real
no,
English
not a mathimal.
It's in the $2 million, which is now in Sipes' possession. It turns out Sloan stole the money from a special CIA contingency fund when he realized he didn't have a chance at survival. Jonathan finds the list hidden on an out-of-sequence $100 bill, buried within the money. With Sipes being discovered to be a traitor, he tries unsuccessfully to dispose of Jonathan and Ty. Meanwhile, the Russians have abducted Brooke and Terry in their own pursuit of the list, and they use a deadly truth serum on Terry, hoping she'll tell what she knows about the list. Transformed into a panther, of course, Jonathan overpowers Sipes, and he and Ty save Brooke just as the Russians are about to inject Terry with a lethal dose of the truth serum. With Sipes and the Russians apprehended and with the list now in the right hands, Terry can find comfort in knowing that her father did not die in vain, and they don't even mention the elephant.
That's one of the only notes that I took was Jonathan can talk. What did I put here? Jonathan can talk to elephants like Aquaman can talk to fish with a question.
Yes. He's yeah. got little red
like,
line.
That's
the
a new, I mean, we know that he was friendly with the animals before, mm-hmm. but he wasn't necessarily like Ant-Manning with them, but that's
yes, exactly.
Seemingly what he's doing in this episode.
Because yeah. the end of the episode is there, the Russians have Brooke, our sweet, sweet Melody Anderson, whom I'm finding more attractive with each episode.
Absolutely.
I don't know what it is. She was in Flash Gordon, and she was great there. You know, I'm just I think she's very copy in the first episode.
Yep.
Where she becomes more friendly and flirty as
well. She was copy. Yeah, that's a good way of putting it.
It was like Jonathan was kind of pervy in the pilot, but they're becoming sort of closer and becoming kind of more closer. They're becoming
he's
closer.
Not,
and
well, he's not doing the like, and also in her defense, he's not doing the say kind of a pervy line and wink at the camera kind of stuff anymore at this point.
Yes.
He's taking it as a much more almost like a Higgins from Magnum PI approach. Like, do you know what I mean? Like he's kind of stuffy. Like,
he put a little bit of stuffy on.
He's gone to a couple operas by now. Like he's
yes.
really in the role.
And when the two of them talk, they're always blocked in such a way that they stand much closer than, say, Charlie, you and I would talk.
They did the same thing in Moonlighting all the time. I don't know if they did the same thing with those two.
Yes, exactly.
But that was, you know, meant for a flirtatious thing. Whereas in Manimal, I think what they were shooting with was just they only had such a big a window to get the
gadget. Yeah, exactly. And I can't imagine.
You're going to be out of frame, Melody. Get in there.
They couldn't have been, I don't think, shooting to have the characters get together that soon. This is something you tease in 83. This is something you tease for seasons.
Yeah, this is something you tease. Like, you only get like a handhold or something like that at like the end of the first season as a cliffhanger or something.
Yeah, exactly.
Sure, it's because they were friends or because they became lovers.
Yeah, you know, like at the end of the first season where you meet the anti-manimal or something. I don't know who turns into like stone or something. Or
no,
he could turn into
an animal
too.
That turns into humans.
Oh, that's
and
it.
So he's like a panther that can turn into like anybody, any human.
And so you have these. Oh yeah, oh
almost
my
like
gosh.
Like that's, a species like a species
like the X-Files, the aliens in the X-Files, the shape-shifting aliens in the X-Files.
I'm not oh well. I'm not. I was never a big X-Files fan, so I'm not too.
But we can do species too. We can do species. Oh, I love that. And the climax would be sort of there seems to be this sort of brace of humans who are coming after Manimal, and in the end they stop them, but there's some sort of some sort of sign that wait a minute, there's a panther leaving or something.
Yeah,
like
yeah,
that.
Totally.
What?
Like, where's he going?
Or maybe it's not a black panther. Maybe it's like the opposite, like in a sort of an albino.
It's like
panther,
a snow leopard,
like a white. Yeah, like a sort of pure white panther or something.
Or make it like undoubtedly Canadian, and it's like a moose. Or like a
did you see that moose running from...
or something like a mountain lion or something, just something like what is that? And they're like, that's right, oh it's gosh, reversed Manimal Canadian.
It's reversed, and that episode is so crazy that at the end of it, Brooke and Jonathan kind of hold hands and walk away from the scene, and the episode ends on some sort of devastated field or forest or something, and the two of them are walk away holding hands, and it freeze frames on that.
It does, but right before it freeze frames on that, it
there's
pans,
a joke.
It pans down, and we see her tracks, his tracks, and moose tracks.
Oh, my gosh. I was going to say, and then we see Ty do something really wacky.
Well, Ty would ruin it. Oh, Ty could be the reverse Manimal.
Oh, my gosh. I didn't even thought of that. Because he was Glenn Turman,
yes!
And then he became Michael Roberts.
Oh, if they had changed okay, we're getting way off topic here, but I have to say this. If they had changed the actor who played Ty in every episode, then you and I could absolutely bring out Reverse Manimal now as a 30-year-old sequel to Manimal.
Oh,
and
my God.
Be about like what happened with Ty and why that was happening.
Could you? I would bet, and then we'll get to the actual episode. But could you imagine if it was something like, if we could go back through the 8 episodes and find like a character who only appeared briefly, or maybe like the guy who gets killed at the beginning of this one,
showing that episode from his point of view.
His point of view, and he's actually Reverse Manimal leading Manimal into the Bahamas, and something that he does there. Like, maybe Doug McClure isn't the bad guy, and he's planted something to make it look like he. Oh my gosh.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, folks, if you know, if you've been listening to the show, you know that Amy the Conqueror and I were constantly doing our Voyagers, futuristic Voyagers episodes. And this is, I like these Manimal
stories.
There you
go. There you go.
Oh, my gosh.
This is a great way for us to wrap it back around to the discussion of the episode, because there's one thing that I need to say about this episode, and for
Let's
me, it's the elephant in the room, is that everything that we've just described would be much more exciting than this episode to me. It takes close to half an hour before we even get the panther.
Yes.
And that's the first transformation. Like, it is it's actually like 22 minutes, but it is a very talky 22 minutes.
It's an episode where they it looks like they actually do go to the Bahamas briefly, but then it looks like the budget was exhausted by those brief shots where they went to the Bahamas, and then most of the episodes is a bunch of people standing in small offices arguing.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's tough to, I mean, I've got the episode actually playing right now, and they're taking Brooke and Terry into this dockside room to interrogate them, and Melody Anderson is in a very low-cut dress.
She's pretty cute.
I have a note here, and the note is where is the note? It's
I don't know. It's your note.
Here's the note. It's boobies.
Hey.
And so it was like, I don't know. Oh, and boobies followed by boob around. I don't know what that is. I think that was a kid's show
boob,
from the 70s.
Boob Around?
Boob Around. That's just one word. Boob Around.
Boob
you know, like,
Around. Like B-O-O-B, yeah, O-B around?
Around. Like we're having a boob around.
Okay. I never heard that term.
I never heard that either. But
you just made it up.
Yeah, because what happens is you see Terry, who is the daughter of Glenn Corbett. And Glenn Corbett, I know, who's the guy who's killed in the beginning, and I think it's done by the tarantula. Glenn Corbett, I know best from, he's been in a ton of stuff. I know him best from The Stranger, which was a TV movie from the mid-70s, which they covered on Mystery Science Theater as Stranded in Space.
Okay.
And he's also on a recent episode of The Immortal that I covered, where he, Sylvia, the episode where he and Christopher George get in a lot of car chases to try to get away from jerks together.
Oh, those jerks.
There are a lot of jerks. That's the immortal.
So many
thing.
Jerks. We're all, you know, that's just life. If we're all trying to just get away from jerks,
we're all just trying. We're in a car chase, trying to get a metaphorical car chase.
Yeah, that's
to
life.
Get away from jerks.
That's what life is in 2017.
No. Briefcase.
And you get Brooke and Terry in this final scene with where they're injecting Terry with the truth serum. And this is the scene where I don't quite know how this happens. This is Glenn A. Larson logic. But they're in this, like, giant metal box room on the edge of a dock. And suddenly Jonathan and Ty show up. And they're like, how do we get in there and stop them? And about 30 feet away, there's an elephant. and Ty goes into the room.
Yeah.
Ty goes into the room, is able to get the ladies out at the same moment that the elephant pushes this entire room into the ocean. And it's not Jonathan. Because the final moment, it's like the snake. It's like Brooke stands there going, come on, Jonathan.
And then he walks in and he's like, hello.
He walks in and then she gets picked up by the trunk and lifted into the air, which looks real.
Yeah, that does look.
It looks like they lifted Melanie Anderson up in the air with an elephant trunk, and that's where it freeze frames.
Yeah. Well, why not, though, right?
Exactly.
There's one joke that Manimal loves telling, and it's the, hey, here's a tarantula that you should all be scared of, but you wouldn't be because it's Jonathan Chase. And then, there's Jonathan Chase. Like, they love that joke in this show.
Let's go. I'd like to think that here's the thing with Glenn A. Larson shows, because this one is written by Glenn A. Larson, which worries.
Oh, I didn't notice that. Oh,
yeah,
that does worry me.
That worries me because he co-created the show, and he was at this early time. He would have been the guy in charge. He would have been the guy who was able to push the show through and get it made. So if this is what he thinks the show is,
yeah,
and this episode truly. I love Doug McClure to bits. You all know that. Although I will say, do you notice the first scene with Doug McClure? He shows up at the airport. They've all arrived in the Bahamas, and he shows up and he goes up to Terry and he's like, "You don't remember me, but I worked with your dad." And he acts like he is a little bit. I hesitate to say it because I don't want it to sound like, is it slander? But he acts like he's a little sauced or something. I know he had a problem with the sauce.
Now I wonder.
Because if you go back and watch that, he's fine in the other scenes.
Yeah.
But watch him in that scene. Like some of the way like he puts his hands on her face and the way he delivers some of the lines, he's like, wow. He's like, that's a little weird.
Maybe he just needed a couple drinks at the airport bar there.
Possibly. Yeah.
We've all indulged at an
airport. We've all done that.
We've all paid $9 for a $2 drink.
for a fantastic $2 drink. Yeah, and I just, before we get back to the episode, you folks know I love Doug McClure. Satan's Triangle, the TV movie, is one of my all-time
favorites.
When
you had mentioned his name, I was like, that's who he is. I know his face more than his name. What do I know him from? Like
Cannonball Run 2.
Okay.
Have you seen Cannonball Run 2?
I mean, I've seen all the Cannonball Runs, but that was when I was like 10.
Okay, I was going to say, because I just watched that like a month ago.
I'm looking him up on IMDb right now. It's definitely not that.
Jamie Farr is the sheik in that, who arranges the Cannonball Run, and Doug McClure plays his servant. But no,
I'm looking him up right now. I know the two right away. Humanoids from the Deep and whatchamacallit, The House Where Evil Dwells, that samurai movie.
Yep.
Both movies that I love and own multiple copies of.
Yeah. Have you got The House Where Evil Dwells? I think came out in a Blu-ray with Ghost Warrior.
No, I have the cheapo blue or the cheapo DVD that it's now worth a bunch of money.
Oh, keep it then.
Oh yeah, and I wouldn't get rid of it anyways because I have that movie on VHS and DVD, and it's one of those movies that's just doesn't get a lot of praise, but it's fantastic.
It's really like surprises you.
Yeah, it's so different than what you expect.
Like, yes, exactly. Yeah. But Doug McClure, I know him from...
And Humanoids from the Deep, of course.
So. Humanoids from the Deep, I know him from... Well, Cannonball Run 2, just because I watched it. But he is in two of my favorite TV shows, along with my favorite TV movie. Mm-hmm. He is in Search, which we will cover one day on here. That's a show from 72-73, created by Leslie Stevens, who was the creator of The Outer Limits.
Okay.
And that's an awesome, fantastic show. It's more or less sort of super secret agents... And he was one of three rotating lead guys.
What's it called?
Search.
Search.
You can the TV movie that began preceded it was called Probe.
Okay.
And Hugh O'Brien, who was an actor who passed away about a year ago, he was the star of that. And then the actual series ran for one season, and it alternates between Hugh O'Brien as a very sort of James Bondy type character, a secret agent who's sent around the world to do stuff. Tony Franciosa, if you know...
Tony Franciosa.
You know, have you seen Tenebrae? Oh,
of course, yeah. Actually,
He's the guy. He's the author.
Oh, really?
Tenebrae. Yeah.
Really?
Okay. He plays like a tough New York cop who's employed by this agency. And Doug McClure is kind of like the beach bum surfer guy who gets employed by them.
Crazy.
And then, of course, Doug McClure also plays... Trampas in The Virginian, which is my favorite television western, which ran for 9 seasons.
A couple years ago, I met a man named Trampas, and I thought I had never heard that name before, but now that you say that.
Depending upon his age, he was probably named after the character because the show was on for 9 years and it's super beloved.
He was like our age.
Oh, okay, yep. It probably was, yep, yeah. Because that show went off the air in 71, so.
Trust me.
So that's the Doug McClure story.
That's the Doug McClure show.
So let's dive in a little bit more to Night of the Scorpion. Now, what is it? It's slowly paced. What else about it might kind of rub you the wrong way?
Well, now when you said Larson was the guy who wrote this one as well, and you said it worried you, it kind of worries me too. Not worries me, but makes me scratch my head a little bit because I don't feel like this episode is a great representation of the show as a whole.
Yes.
And not that that's a bad thing or anything like that, mm-hmm. but to come out with that as your third episode in the series seems very... In your first episode, you've already changed ties. And then now, mm-hmm. In the third episode, you've made it like a very cop drama without cops, really.
Yes.
And in the worst possible way of that. I'm not. I feel like I'm coming across a little harsh on it, but also I think I'm kind of right. So.
I think so too. I mean, it is great to see in this episode, as you may know from the beginning of this segment, Jonathan becomes a parrot.
Yeah.
And listens in a cover, and that's fun to see. I like that they're doing new animals.
Yeah.
But then there is something weird about the fact that the. It's one thing to have him not become a snake in the middle of an episode, but to have him not become an elephant and save the day at the end of an episode feels a bit like Jonathan's phoning it in or something like that.
Everything about this episode felt phoned in, like that you're saying that. Like, it was boring. I hate to say it, but I found it boring and tedious.
Yeah, I don't know if I've actually said this in a podcast, but up until about 10 or so years ago, I couldn't watch hour-long shows.
Oh, really?
I couldn't. I found them so formulaic. I found them tedious. I couldn't do it. But gradually, I started to get into it. And so every once in a while, I'll sit down and watch an episode of, say, like Manimal here.
Yeah.
And I'll feel like that's just me. that's just the way I used to be. I'm like, okay, these are formulaic, but I got to catch the groove. But the problem is I watched Night of the Scorpion once and took notes on it. When I'm taking notes, I don't know that I'm paying attention to the pace fully because I'm just trying to get all the information. But I watch it a second time. And when I watched it the second time, all I thought was this really is, like, half of it is people sitting in Doug McClure's office. There are long stretches of people sitting in, like, a safety deposit box room in a bank just looking at things. There's that sequence in the end with the Russians injecting Terry seems to go on, like, 3 minutes longer than it should.
Well, and that's some of the most exciting stuff that happens in the episode, too.
Yes.
Like, which is bizarre.
Now, once again, young lady, and this time we'll give you a full, possibly lethal dosage if you don't complete your little story. Where is the list hidden?
JC, we gotta get in there, man. That's the stuff that used to kill her father. Ty, I think I brought an idea.
You don't have to do that. I'll tell you.
You know where the list is?
Yeah. We found it right away. That is, my partner and I did. We didn't even tell Terry.
That's a very convenient story, my dear. The only trouble is that I can prove it within minutes. And just how much time do you think you bought for yourself?
Try me.
All right, stop it, little fuck. Get up here. Come on, move it. Get Terry and go here.
Come on, man, move.
Do you realize you can't possibly shoot all of us before we could shoot at least two of you?
Yeah, but my first bullet takes you out, big fella. Now you like them apples.
I have no choice but to die for my cause. Gentlemen, you will kill this intruder with your first shot, Miss Mackenzie with your second. That will leave you with Miss Sloan to locate the list.
Now, hold on, Tommy, brother. I mean, let's not get hysterical about this thing.
That's what I thought. Take them.
It's, you think that, like, when they say, we're going to the Bahamas, you think it's going to take off and become exciting.
It'd be like a party episode.
Yeah, exactly. But the sort of party sequence is they go to a restaurant where, like, a Calypso band is playing and everyone's doing the limbo, and then Ty does the limbo, but not really. And it feels that feels like very much like a low-rent sort of James Bond sequence, because at the end, Doug McClure and the Terry character leave, and then they get attacked, and Jonathan tries to, you know, comes after him and stuff like that. But it's weird because they show us that we're in the Bahamas, but then they do this limbo restaurant sequence, which could have been shot right here in Los Angeles.
Could have been shot in Milwaukee.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it could have been shot Walla Walla, Washington, yeah, or really, Medicine Hat. Yeah. It doesn't really, you know, who knows where it could have been shot. You know, it's a strange episode that sort of. The plot itself is not a bad one.
It's just executed slowly.
When I read the synopsis, I was thinking, my God, this is an exciting episode. But then I would look to my left and I just see everyone sitting in Doug McClure's office with a parrot. And I thought, no, there's
what's missing. Oh, I know. It's action.
Action.
It's adventure.
It's
boardrooms. That's what it is.
I'm wondering too. Do you think maybe this was like a script Glenn A. Larson had written for something else, possibly,
and just shoehorned Manimal in there,
and just stuck Manimal in, maybe like a show like not a Quincy, but something like it where it wasn't meant to be action adventure.
But then how were they so out of ideas by the third episode? Like, if they were like, oh man, we don't have a writer or director for this episode, just throw Lars in there. What do you got, buddy? He's like, police story. Here you go. Okay, right.
You know, I'd love to say that this was a Battlestar Galactica episode that he rewrote.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, just it seems weird that they had to resort to that in episode three. But maybe, I guess I'm feeling spoiled because we kind of live in a world now where our shows are very much serialized. At least our best shows are.
Yes.
And
yes.
Not necessarily the case back then. So I keep saying, third episode, blah, 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 blah. This might have been like the last episode they shot. It could have been second episode they shot, right? Like, yeah. So they aired things a little bit differently back then. So,
I'll have to look into that. Maybe I can.
Yeah.
Maybe we might be able to get the production code somewhere. But the, there is a weird feeling throughout this episode. Like, it's like in the previous episode with the magicians, I think they kept it pretty exciting throughout, if I remember correctly. That was 2 weeks ago, folks. I can't be expected to remember.
Yeah, he's got this, a lot on his plate.
I remember that being a fun episode, but this is so weird because I'm wondering if it was something like, you know, they Glenn A. Larson came in and said, no, this, and this is me throwing down papers, this is the way we do Manimal.
This is, I'm going to show you Manimal. None of this winking at the camera, none of this flirty stuff, just straight up talking.
Just straight up lots of talking. I mean, there is a lot of talking, folks. Yeah. And so what I'll do is I'm going to look at my notes and see if I can find something that's maybe not talking related that I could talk about. Now, first off, of course, I do like the way Jonathan, I mean, it's not terribly exciting, but the way he finds the list.
I can't remember.
Where he because the guy has left $2 million to his daughter. They find it in the safety deposit box, and it's like he has a bill that's out of place. And as Sipes is standing there, he flips through the bills, and then he pulls out a bill.
Oh, yes.
And he goes, this one's out of place, and he lights a match behind it, and the list has been written, it's kind of like scrawled somehow with some special ink.
True, that's good stuff.
That's pretty good because at the top of the list is Sipes' name, and Sipes is standing directly in front of him.
Now, that is good, because back in – that would have been when that aired. I would have been like all in on that kind of stuff, like secret coded writing messages and stuff like that.
Yes, and can I ask something? Now I don't go to the beach a lot. I live near some beaches, but I'm not a sand guy.
Okay.
Sand bothers me.
Okay.
But they're in the Bahamas. You're pretty much near a beach everywhere.
Yeah. I think the Bahamas is one beach. Well, multiple beaches, I guess.
and so you see that their hotel is right near a beach. So you figure if you're seeing people sort of dress scantily or something like that, they're probably going to the beach or from the beach.
Correct.
So the very first shot we see at the hotel, the camera sort of pans over some people, and then you see our three main you see Ty and you see Jonathan and Terry walk towards the camera and past him. But the camera focuses on two young ladies, two blonde young ladies, and they're lovely. And they're both in kind of small shirts and tight shorts. And they kind of walk by the camera, and the camera kind of lingers on them for a bit, and you think, all right, they've been at the beach. But, and here's something I noticed the second time I watched it, and I thought, is this beach wear? Because one of them is wearing sneakers. I thought, okay. But the other is wearing perfectly clean, shiny, white high heel shoes.
Oh, I didn't even notice.
And it's really weird because you think, did she just come from the beach? Is she going to the beach? Why is she wearing white high heels?
Maybe she's a stripper and she was just going.
I didn't think about
somewhere
that.
Somewhere else. Or coming they from don't... somewhere else.
That's true. I hadn't thought about that. Okay, that clears that note up. All right. I hadn't really thought about that. Okay.
The answer is to life's questions.
Like a stripper. Let me take a last look at my notes here. Yeah, I like. You know, some of the episodes are going to be better than others, folks.
Well, maybe the fourth episode is my favorite episode of the series. Well, I guess we'll find out when we talk about it.
Yeah, so I'm looking at my notes, and I kind of think that's all I have on this one. It's a lot of people standing in rooms and talking, and it seems like it should be bigger than it is, but it doesn't quite make it. He becomes a parrot, and that's fine. It's not terribly exciting. Yeah, it's not terrible. It's fun that he becomes a parrot, but it's not what actually happens. Is sort of like they could have put a little microphone in. He could have hid under a desk or something. But yeah. Any final thoughts?
No, I'm cool on Night of the Scorpion.
Okay.
Was there one question I guess I have before we wrap it up? Was the truth serum made from scorpion venom? Is that where this came from?
I guess that's where the title comes from.
Okay, because
yeah.
I was hoping there was going to be a scorpion transformation of some sort.
Me too. Well, I kind of thought that too when I saw Night of the Scorpion. My first thought was he's going to become a scorpion. He's going to threaten someone with a little jab, maybe a giant scorpion like the Black Scorpion or something.
Yeah,
but no, I think that's what it. To be honest, this really is. Every once in a while, I watch an episode of something for this show, or like when we wrote the Bleeding Skull book, there was a movie in there called Appointment with Fear that I watched 4 times. And every time I watched it, I came upon something where I was like, this happens in the movie? And I couldn't remember it at all. And Night of the Scorpion is sort of like that. I've watched it almost 3 times for this. And I don't remember fully where the scorpion thing is from. And there are moments where I go, oh, I forgot that happened.
Yeah.
It's a weird episode that doesn't fully stay in the mind. I'm not saying you guys should, please do not skip.
But also don't like watch it and get bored and not finish the series.
Yes, exactly. Because it's, and I hate to say it because the creator did it, but back then shows were very, sort of quality of the show a lot of time was from the script, because there weren't because nowadays we have writers' rooms where, you know, like one person will write a draft and then 8 other people will tear it apart and restructure it. So you keep a pretty solid level of quality throughout a series. But back in 83, back in the 70s, back in the 60s, they didn't really do that. You turned in a script and they made a few changes here and there, but they just more or less shot it as it's turned in. And so you could get very iffy sometimes. Now, the fact that it's Glenn A. Larson doing it makes, like I said, a little worrisome. But I would like us to celebrate Melody Anderson's low-cut top.
With a boob around.
With a boob around. And the fact that Jonathan became a new animal. He became a parrot in this one. I was going to say Parriot. But Parriot. James Parriot is the creator of Voyagers. So
Voyager's on the mind still.
Yeah, so it's crazy. Let's wrap this one up and wrap it up. Charlie or Chuck, as I refer for you affectionately. Where can we find you online? What's up with you?
What is up with me? I don't know what's up with me right now. The Browns, BrownsMania.com, I believe is our website.
Awesome.
And Podcast Mania, of course, PodcastManiaFun.com. I'm really good at URLs, as you can tell. I just add the word fun or mania after something and make it my own. That's about it. Browns are playing a bunch of shows. No, the Browns have nothing booked. We just planned on recording a new split 7-inch, though, with another band. So we'll talk more about that another time. But yeah.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah, maybe on the next segment. Maybe. Give us a little more info on that. Cool.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
Thank
and
you, Sarah.
Next time we have Female of the Species.
Rawr.
So yeah, we'll take off and we'll be back next time with more Manimal. And is Polly? Polly, are you there to say goodbye?
Polly says bye bye.
We love you, Polly.
Love you.
Thank you, Charlie. Hey everyone, it's Dan closing out episode 27 of the show. I hope you guys enjoyed it. I thought it was a fun one. I thought it was a good time. What are we? What's going on? Okay, so we are on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud. Hopefully you should be listening on one of those. iTunes reviews, Stitcher reviews, any sort of reviews, likes, whatevers are greatly appreciated. Email is esupertrain@yahoo.com. Eventually, supertrain.blogspot.com is the site. You can also go on PolishAmericanGuyReviews.blogspot.com. I'm almost at the end of my second season BJ and the Bear coverage. I will be, I think, one post away when you listen to this. What else? We're on Facebook, Eventually Supertrain. Let's see, eSupertrain1, @eSupertrain1 is our Twitter handle.
And yeah, I got a new book, 80s Action Movies on the Cheap, which I keep calling 80s Action Films in the Rough, but you'll get the gist of it. And my first book, Bleeding Skull, is still available hardcover from Head Press, and it's still available. You can get Kindle on Amazon, so that's cool. Yeah, and that's what's happening here. We just started up the great and wonderful A Minute to Dismember, and I'm about to dive into the movie on that. We've got a new Made for TV Mayhem episode coming up shortly with high school films, which is going to be great. And I think a new podcast, Mania, just went up discussing Devil's Story. And Dan's Driving Double Feature, there'll be a new one up soon. When the 1 minute stuff starts, I kind of get lost in that. So there'll be another Dan's Driving Double Feature soon. So everyone, thank you so much for listening. We will be back in a couple weeks with the next of everything. And it'll be great. And we'll actually be, after our next episode, we'll be halfway through Manimal. Can you believe that? Ooh. So, be good to yourselves. Stay safe. And here's just a little more of our awesome theme song. Good night, everybody. Dun dun ts. 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 Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da